welcome to A Handful of Dust, a podcast where we discuss the ideas and themes that occur to us during a reread of Neil Gaiman's The Sandman. I'm Jenny.
And I'm Eamon, hello.
And as always, we'll start with a content note. Some of these comic books deal with dark and troubling subject matters, and we might refer to them or discuss them in depth in these episodes. And for more information about the topics covered in the books and in this podcast, you can see the show notes for the episode.
Yes, see the email address we've got in the show notes if you need to contact us for time codes and so on. So last time we talked about Merv Pumpkin's housekeeping, so we'll just quickly catch up that James Barry was the British doctor and surgeon who we mentioned in the World's End stories, who was raised as a female but assumed a male identity to study at medical school. I went on to a remarkable career. So James Barry was the name we were trying to remember last time, Jen.
Yeah, I think we discover that like immediately after finishing the recording last time. We were like, oh yeah,
that was the name.
Quick Google.
We should also mention, I suppose, that there are annotated volumes of The Sandman, but there are four of them. They're £40 each. And we've already bought The Sandman a few times already, haven't we? So we haven't invested in the annotated editions. We're doing the best we can as we go along. So, book 9, The Kindly Ones, covering issues 57 to 69, plus an extra issue in the trade, which is the Vertigo Jam one-off story, The Castle, with art by Kevin Noland. So 14 issues in a way to deal with. The longest book, I think, that we've had to do the whole time, isn't it?
It is, and it did feel long when we were rereading.
And it's taken us a bit longer to get round to recording it because it took us a while to read it, didn't it?
Yeah.
So let's start with basically the story, which is, this is the tale of Leta Hall, who we have been introduced to several times along the way, although she was a pre-existing DC character. And this is her tale of vengeance, sort of like her journey to vengeance against Dream, because she believes that Dream has taken her baby Daniel. And she goes on a mythical quest, doesn't she?
She does. There's very much like a quest or a journey narrative in this that is very long and winding, with several different aspects happening all at the same time.
And one of the aspects, obviously, that drives her on, that prompts her to go on this trail of vengeance, of course, is the kindly ones of the titles, the Eumenides, the figures of three women, Mother, Maid and Crone. And I guess one of the things in this book that we've noticed is that there's lots of triads. There's lots of sort of groupings of three things throughout this book. She meets other representations of three, including two Gorgons who want to make their new sister.
Yeah, and we see lots of sort of mythical figures of women scorned as well, or women seeking vengeance.
Yes, because there is that
Gorgons represent as well, I believe.
Yeah. Because there is that interesting interlude in the middle of this trade where Rose Walker goes on a journey back to the UK to visit the nursing home that her grandmother lived and died in. And while she's there, she meets another trio of old ladies who tell stories. And they tell that interesting bit of English folklore, The Flying Children, which is very much a story about a woman scorned by a man, abandoned by a man, isn't it?
Yeah.
With weird, or no, I wouldn't say weird, with sort of beautiful Charles Vess artwork. But it's again, another one of those strange interludes that he keeps throwing in the middle of the major plot.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it before, about Neil Gaiman sort of being full of stories and wanting to put all of those stories in all the time. And I think The Kindly Ones kind of proves the strength of that, but also the weakness of that. Because, yes, that story is great, but it's kind of lost in this, like, huge collection.
Yes. Okay.
But I do like all the little folklore nods. Even when they go over your head, you know, I'm not, like, in any way an expert on all the different mythologies that are linked up in any of Neil Gaiman's work, but especially in The Sandman. But there's like that familiarity of folklore and mythology that lets you sort of like understand what's happening through context clues or just from your own understanding of them. So I think that idea of like women seeking vengeance and being perceived as sort of horrifying because of it is sort of a very common idea throughout mythology around like a patriarchal world. So it's like it's not surprising to read it, but it's just there's a lot. I think Neil Gaiman like links up all the little threads of it from around the world here in The Kindly Ones.
And I did try to find a reference for the flying children story in folklore, and I think it does exist in Grimm's fairy tales, apparently. This is not one that Neil Gaiman's made up. This is one that exists somewhere in the sort of the written record. Obviously, you know, all the Greek stuff is in there. Lots of Greek story and mythology and these characters, the Gorgons, and then the Kindly Ones themselves. There's a snake in a tree that's, I can't remember, is also, is it a three-headed snake as well?
Yeah.
And then meanwhile, while Leta Hall is going about her journey, which actually I should say is depicted rather beautifully, the way I thought it was very clever, the way they show her walking through what are in some panels appears to be normal for the time, Los Angeles. And then from her own point of view is a sort of mythical landscape where she's meeting adventurers and giant cats. It's very, she's travelling in folklore while we see her travelling in the real world.
Yeah, she's sort of stuck between the two places almost.
Meanwhile, Dream is just sort of trying to hold things together in the dreaming. He's going about his business. He's set out. He sends out the New Corinthian, because he creates the New Corinthian, and he sends out the Raven Matthew, and the two of them have to go on their own quest to find the missing boy, Daniel, who's obviously going to be a major plot point towards the end of this volume. And that I thought that was quite fun. You know, they joke about it in the script, you know, like they're a detective couple. He's a nightmare, he's a raven, they solve crimes. But it was that was quite a fun part of it, I thought.
I think any time Matthew the Raven is in the story, and he is in this story quite a bit, is a fun time.
Yeah.
And the New Corinthian is sort of, it's kind of odd to have, you know, we talked about his previous incarnation, and now to have this slightly more like, I don't know, almost like suave, like not quite knight in shining armor kind of vibe, you know, like maybe more like anti-hero kind of thing going on with him in this like pursuit of the baby, the missing Daniel. So we get to meet a new character almost here, which is odd for this book that is entirely made up of old characters.
And he's infinitely preferable to the original Corinthian, isn't he?
Yes,
that's quite interesting stuff. Let's talk about the artwork, because when I was doing my background reading for this episode, I found quite a lot of comments that they found the artwork jarring and strange. It's Mark Hempel, inked by Disraeli, and I thought it was fantastic, actually. I thought the faces looking out of us, you know, looking out at us from the panel, which is a recurring theme, was quite fantastic in the way it depicted Leta Hall's journey and her encounters with all these different characters. What did you think about the artwork?
I love the artwork in The Kindly Ones. I always remember it as being like completely different from any of the other Sandman comics, and I really like it. And yeah, there's like a formality to it. The like panels are laid out a little bit more structured way, and yeah, they play around with the sort of like, I guess breaking the fourth wall would be the easiest way to describe that. Yeah.
Yes.
So you feel a lot closer to the characters, although they're rendered in a slightly like less realistic style. But I don't know if we really talked about, I mean, early on we were talking more about narrative than we were artwork, but I remember in the first volume, I really didn't like the artwork when I first read it, because it felt very 80s. Yes. And it felt very like not the kind of artwork I usually ran across in comic books, whereas this in The Kindly Ones felt a lot more familiar to me, I think. Like, I don't...
Right. So this is 1993, 94, I think. So, you know, we're into 95, in fact. This is I guess, more 90s artwork for us. Something you're a bit more familiar with.
Yeah, I think so. I think the colours, the use of the, like, slightly bolder line work and the, like, slightly more graphic style really makes it work a little bit more for me personally.
Yeah.
And I enjoy reading it, although I think there's moments when it gets a bit repetitive, maybe, is the only thing. But I think that's just because it's such a long volume, such a long story. And, you know, the few times where it's... There are issues where it's, like, slightly different artwork as well. Like, the folklore story, and there's sort of changes a little bit every now and then.
Yes, I think when Rose Walker flies to the UK, Glyn Dillon takes over for that issue.
Yeah, that's right. That's the Rose issue.
Charles Vest does the folklore story that's told in the middle of it. In a very sort of fairy tale sort of fashion, which is interesting. And Glyn Dillon, you know, it is a change. I mean, I think it's great stuff, but it is a change in the middle where we get this Rose Walker interlude, don't we?
Yeah.
Okay, let's turn to some problematical issues with the kindly ones. we knew this was going to happen. It's happened with just about every volume we've talked about. Lita Hall is living in Los Angeles with her son Daniel. We've talked previously about her having that great sort of single parent vibe when she's talking to her friend about things that she does. And her friend is Carla.
Yes, we meet Carla properly.
Yes, we meet Carla. I think we just had Carla on the phone previously, but now this time we meet her. And I think we get the impression that she doesn't live in the same apartment block. Rose Walker's living in the same apartment block, isn't she? But Carla is Lita's best friend at this point. And while Lita is going on her sort of mythical journey, Carla is sort of wrestling with what she thinks is the bureaucracy of police work. But of course, it's not the real police. It's Loki and Puck, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then, of course, in the middle of the kindly ones, she has this encounter with Loki by herself, where he traps her in this car, torments her, and then basically sets her on fire and she burns to death horribly.
Yeah.
It's not great, is it?
It's not great. And I think when we were talking about this before, you rightly pointed out that this is almost identical to what happens to Ruby in Brief Lives.
And we should say, I mean, if anybody doesn't remember, Carla is depicted. She is a black American woman, isn't she?
She is, yes.
She's a person of colour. And so this is almost, as you say, identical to what happened to Ruby in Brief Lives. And later on, when the new Corinthian is investigating death, and he does this weird thing with her eyes, he calls back to that old legend that, you know, a dead person's eyes would record the image of their murderer. So he uses her eyes and he gets flashbacks to another woman dying in a hotel room, and also something to do with the City of Glass, which I think is a reference to Narda's city.
Yeah, the city, because it burns, doesn't it, at the end of, or during her story. Yeah, and it's pretty shitty to kill off all your black female side characters in your story. It's kind of double shitty to claim that they are all the same character.
Yeah.
As well, to sort of lump them in to one existence, to one narrative, is cruel in a way. I think it's like, it's not good writing. It's like, it seems easy, and it does seem like Neil Gaiman is kind of unintentionally pointing directly at this fact of this book, which is, or at, there's the whole Sandman, which is there are so few women of colour in it, so few black women, that there's, you can literally count them.
Yes.
Like, they are literally, like, countable. And, like, that he was aware of that when he was writing it as well sort of makes that obvious, which is not great.
I mean, I just, when it came up, you know, I'd sort of forgotten about it, but when I realised what was happening again, I just thought, literally, oh no, not this again. Why is he doing this? And, you know, it's very weird. I mean, it's as I say, it's 1993, 94 in comics. You correctly identified when we started with the first volume that the presumed audience at the time was white males. We know, because we've spoken about this before, that the diversity in the readership of Sandman grew and grew and became much more a factor as the series was so successful, and it was a part of the success. It just seems such an odd thing to do, and to try and link it to the other deaths is really weird. And I don't know what connection he was trying to make. It doesn't seem to work for us, does it?
I think, you know, if we gave him the benefit of the doubt and say that he was, you know, we mentioned this in when we talked about The World's End, where, you know, he creates a character who directly points to the maleness of his stories. He writes that in, is kind of like acknowledging that bias that he has in his writing, but it doesn't,
yes,
it doesn't really make sense when we know at this point Neil Gaiman has like full control of the story and is perfectly within his like control to add more characters, to change the characters, you know, to like do something more with them rather than like resign them to the same fate. Like at this point, Carla doesn't have to die necessarily. Like her death is actually not hugely important to the story. You know, Lita, we never see Lita finding out, do we? I'm trying to think.
I don't think we do. I don't think we find out, you know, how Lita reacts to the death of her best friend.
I think there is maybe a note of it in the next volume. I'm trying to remember. I feel like there's a scene that I have in my head that maybe is next, or maybe I've just invented it. So yet Carla's death doesn't feel hugely important to the narrative of The Kindly Ones and isn't really noted on after that encounter, after the Corinthian finds her. It's just a sort of like, she's a clue for the Corinthian in a way to find Daniel. And that feels, it's just pretty shitty. It's just another example of how, like, a lot of the fiction and storytelling that came out at this time point maintained the sort of, like, racism of the time. And it still does today, you know?
Yes.
And you always hope that you'll go back and revisit something that you loved as a child and find it to be perfect and flawless. But unfortunately, we've kind of discovered that The Sandman is not that.
We're both big fans of Neil Gaiman, and we're not suggesting that he's in any way racist other than reflecting, I think, common practices at the time in 93, 94 in comics. One of the things we've talked about before is how the Endless themselves appear to people. And we know particularly Dream himself will change his appearance depending on who is perceiving him. And I think we've seen the other Endless do that to a certain extent, particularly in clothing, more so than appearance. But it strikes me, you've mentioned this before, Jenny, he's a very pale white person, which in turn makes us the perceivers. I guess it's just saying, you know, there's more white people reading this comic in a way, and perhaps it's a reflection of that. It just seems, reading it now, it just seems so awful a thing to happen, which, as you say, is really only just to give the new Corinthian a clue, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think, you know, the Endless is a reflection of the people who perceive him, and it's a large amount, or for a really long time, the perceived audience of comic books was white, straight, cis men, as we've talked about before, and as the audience got more diverse in terms of gender and maybe in terms of sexuality as well, it still remains to be, seems, is perceived to be incredibly white still. And obviously, like, we know that that's not the case, but that's the perception, because that's the, like, default position for a lot of us who exist in this racist society, basically. So yeah, it's not a sort of problem with the individual. It's a problem with the society and the culture at large, but it is also on the individual to step up and change those things. So I think there's a little bit of disappointment for me that Neil Gaiman would notice that he was writing these characters, you know, the three black female characters in the book, and then not do anything to change it here at the last minute. But there's a lot going on in The Kindly Ones. It maybe would have been needed a different story and not the finale arc of The Sandman.
Yes, it provides a link in the chain for the new Corinthian and Matthew to investigate, but that's about it. And as I was approaching it and reading it and remembering what was going to happen, I was quite appalled, especially in view of what you and I have been talking about for the last 8 episodes. Okay, I also notice, I don't know if you noticed the newspaper headline towards the end of the book, that Rose Walker has a relationship with a young solicitor in Britain. who we learn from a phone call is in a relationship with someone else. And it's sort of possibly suggested at the end of the book that he may have committed suicide, rather unfortunately and tragically. And I just thought that was unfortunate as well. Introduce a character who is in the newspaper reports called, you know, referred to as gay. I don't know, did you notice that bit?
I hadn't noticed that, but that is, yeah, that's not great.
Another, yeah, again, you know, it just seemed like a weird thing to do. Why, you know, it was okay for him to have a relationship with Rose and then to have a phone call where he was obviously with someone else. I didn't understand really why he had to die and it had to be referred to in the end.
Especially not to come, I'm looking at it now, to come after the storyline that we've had with Zelda being HIV positive or dying from HIV and AIDS, and then Rose to reconnect with Hal, and for them to have this like slightly confusing conversation about like the HIV epidemic. And yeah, there's an odd thing happening here at the end that I was never quite sure about, with sort of, yeah, it's not really clear what's gone on. I don't know whether Neil Gaiman is expecting us to pick up on something.
Yes, we get, because Rose Walker, as we've said, is in this volume, and one of the things Rose Walker is doing is visiting one of the spider women from A Doll's House, Zelda, who is in a hospice dying of HIV AIDS, as you say, which her partner contracted through a kidney transplant, yeah. I believe. So Chantel, the other spider woman, has already passed away. And Hal from the Doll's House, the landlord from the Doll's House, has gone on to become a sort of television drag queen personality, appearing on talk shows, and seems quite bitter and disaffected, possibly again after the events of the Doll's House.
Yeah, it's not really clear, because I think in the Doll's House, Hal appears to be quite like a warm character, who sort of welcomes Rose, and this seems to be quite an abrupt change. Yeah, again, seems to be, I don't know if there's something, I think maybe it's just the use of like the storyline of HIV as like something happening in the background, again seems to be like adds to the world building, but actually does little service to, say, representation of like a queer community who at this point in time were dealing with this like quite horrible thing happening, to just again use it as sort of like a little extra thing that's happening in Rose's life and not really necessarily connected to the narrative feels a little bit throwaway. Yeah. And then yeah, that headline at the end,
it seemed odd. I don't know why he put it in. Why did we need that at all? Couldn't he have left that, you know, I forgot what the solicitor's name is, but couldn't he have left him alone?
Yeah.
And just had Rose going back to America from another, you know, unhappy little fling that she'd had.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff I feel with like Rose's story that feels, not that like she's not allowed to change as a character, but feels very different from where we left her at the end of the Doll's House.
Changing the subject slightly, did you get the impression that Rose Walker, since the events of the Doll's House, no longer ages?
Yes, there's definitely something going on there, because they mention it a couple of times.
That she appears so young. And that, you know, by taking her heart out of herself to give it to Unity Kincaid at the end of A Doll's House, that somehow she may have become another one of Neil Gaiman's immortal characters.
Yeah, it does feel like there's the implication of that, or that she's got her grandmother's life as well. There's something, the swapping of the hearts at the end of Doll's House.
And then Desire appears to her at one point, literally in the cell where of the house where Dream was captured by Burgess and the his acolytes, right beside the big glass sphere that he was imprisoned in. And Desire is there and gives a heart-shaped, very Art Deco heart-shaped cigarette lighter to Rose Walker. Is she giving her heart back? And also, I think the reveal there, the Desire, of course, is Rose Walker's grandparent.
Yes, I mean, we've had that before, haven't we? An indication that Desire is the one who magically impregnates Unity, or in another way of putting that, is the person responsible for raping Unity at the beginning of the Sandman comics. Yeah, and that this connection here, then I've just put two and two together in my brain and figured out, like, literally just now as we were talking, that we then discover that Rose is pregnant at the end of this. And I had also presumed that it was the solicitor, and now have just finally clicked in my brain, it's probably Desire's baby again. So...
Oh, no. You think that interlude and Desire giving her the cigarette lighter or the heart, that may be where the pregnancy comes from and not from the young solicitor.
I think so, and I was just, because I was going to say, like, one of the things I find it odd about Rose's story is that, like, she's sent on this, like, quest by a vision of her grandmother to, like, go back to England, and it's never clear why, and then it doesn't really go anywhere. And I was going to say, it's odd that there's this story going on with Rose Walker, and, like, what is the purpose of it other than to sort of connect up the dots with, is it Alex Burgess, who's the guy who's put into, like, eternal waking at the end of the first book. Is it the first book or the second book?
Yeah, it's at the end of, the first issue, isn't it? He's the son of the original Burgess, I think, who
So we get this sort of, like, wrapping up of that story. So I was like, is that the only reason that we're sort of given that, and then we're just confirming Desire's involvement in all of this still further? And, yeah, just now I just clicked that maybe that's the indication here. This is a, like, foreshadowing cliffhanger ending of, like, who is the father or the, like, non-gendered entity responsible for Rose's pregnancy? It's probably Desire, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness. So we know Desire plays games. Is Desire playing another game for the future?
Setting up another game.
One game is coming to an end. Desire's setting up another one. We should probably know. I mean, I know Rose Walker reoccurs in The Wake, which is the final volume we'll be getting to hopefully next week. I don't know if she turns up in any of the Dreaming stories afterwards. I hope she does.
Yeah,
Do we ever find out what happens to her child?
I don't remember any reference to that, but I guess it's possible.
Okay, we'll perhaps come back to that when we get to The Wake.
I'm trying to think, nothing is familiar yet, and I haven't got to reading The Wake yet.
Okay, but huge revelation there as we're just literally reading it, that Jenny has figured out Desire is at it again, playing Desire's games.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about Desire's representation in the book and, like, about how kind of problematic it is to have something, to have the, like, essence of Desire be portrayed as this, like, controlling negative.
Manipulative.
Yeah, he's always pushing for, like, abusive, crossing-the-line relationships. I've always found that to be kind of problematic, and I was chatting to a friend and they said, and it's kind of weird that negative aspect is, like, tied into the depiction of Desire as having no gender, as well as, like, not being either truly feminine or truly masculine. Therefore, like, that's where the Desire gets mixed up. And then that person also rightfully went on to say, and then you get the aspect that is Despair, who's depicted as, like, a fat woman and, like, representing despair. And it's just sort of like these characterizations of these feelings as being, like, Desire being non-gendered and negative, and Despair being negative but gendered female, is just another aspect that feels a little bit awkward and problematic looking back at them now. So yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about Desire anymore.
No, or Despair, really. I mean, Despair obviously seems like quite a sad character, always sad about the loss of her brother, but always depicted as a sort of short, fat woman with a very sort of, what should we say, a not sort of comic book pretty face, sort of an ugly face with protruding teeth and, you know, the weird hook ring that Despair wears and constantly seems to be digging into herself, into her mouth, and causing bleeding, self-harming in a way. Despair and Desire, the twins of the Endless, perhaps the problematical parts of the Endless, the ones that we don't particularly like now looking back on their depictions. How about I turn you to one of the Endless who is more engaging and fun and entertaining, and that Delirium does indeed appear in this volume.
Yes, Delirium is back, and she's my favourite, and she's my favourite in this run as well. I would like to give a shout out to the way that she is depicted in this art, because it is my favourite depiction of her visually. There's a couple of different iterations, as always, with Delirium. She changes her hair and her fishnets regularly. So she comes in a sort of, like, rainbow denim jacket look, I think. And then she turns up with her red and yellow hair and fishnets. And then in the end, we finally see her in LA meeting Lucifer and being reunited with her dog. And she wears
Barnabas. Hooray.
She gets pink and purple hair and this like great oversized t-shirt look, which has to be my favorite because it is a Halloween costume that I wore a couple of years ago. me and my flatmate dressed up as Dream and Delirium, and I chose that outfit because it was like, I think it's because I could get the wig. I could get a pink wig and make it work. Yeah, so it's become my favorite, and I'm wearing the t-shirt that I made that says hello right now.
Hey,
can see it.
our listeners can't, yeah. But I can see it on the video.
Maybe I might be able to unearth a picture, but maybe not. I don't know. I have to, like, I think all my Facebook pictures are dead now, but yeah.
Okay, so your favourite sort of depiction of Delirium, yeah, in her, with her pink hair and her t-shirt and reunited with Barnabas and also having incredibly witty things to say to Lucifer and Lucifer's, what would you call her, Lucifer's sort of partner, follower, Mazikeen,
yeah,
the half-faced woman.
And I think we've had indications before, like really early on when we first meet Delirium, at that like family dinner at Destiny's place, and then in Brief Lives we get hints of it as well, but like Delirium's ability to understand the world and particularly understand the world of the Endless shines through here. So when she pops up and talks to Dream and when she talks to Lucifer, and she even talks to the fairy Nuala as well, we actually get a lot of like context from her and a lot more understanding of like the world that the Endless exist in, which has been always been my favorite thing about Delirium, that she sort of cuts through all the rules and the like things that you're not supposed to say, and she says the truth often.
There's a scene in part 8 of The Kindly Ones where Delirium is in, I think, Dream's library with him, talking to him, and amazingly for Delirium, like you say, she can cut through and understand the Endless. And I'm going to refer, I think for the second time in this podcast history, to The Princess Bride, because she talks about, Dream once again mentions responsibilities, and she doesn't quite say, you keep using that word, I do not think it means what you think it means. But she more or less does, doesn't she?
She does, yeah.
You know, that he keeps banging on about responsibilities. We've talked about this in previous episodes. And again, Delirium calling him on it and saying, actually, I don't think you understand what the responsibilities are and how much, as she says herself, how much we distort reality. Things change around us. It's a fascinating page. It's, you know, almost Delirium, even though her eyes are different colours at this point, but almost Delirium at her most cogent, seeing through Dream's bullshit yet again. Yeah.
And I think there's Delirium has those moments, and I think also Matthew the Raven has those moments towards the end where he's sort of like continuously questioning Dream about like what's going on and why it's happening, and every time Dream is like, well, you know, it's the rules, and Matthew's like, the rules again, and it's just like, yeah. I think, yeah, there's like this, these two characters sort of become, they're almost like, to me, they feel like my perspective on the story of being like, so why are we doing this again? What's happening again?
Yes.
Like, why is this important? I'm not sure. I'm not following the rules exactly. Why are the rules not written down?
Well, let's take you to the end where we get Leta Hall as the personification of the Furies, the Kindly Ones, has invaded the Dream Inn. We've seen various characters, some of whom, you know, the ones that we know and love, have been killed off in this battle that's going on. And it leads to this final confrontation with Dream standing on a sort of pinnacle of rock, initially with all his armour on, his helmet and his cloak and everything. But he sort of like, he takes it all off. He sends Matthew, who's been complaining to him about following the rules again and saying, you know, what's going on. He sends Matthew with his items back to the heart of the Dream Inn, and literally stands there, takes his shirt off for the final confrontation. And I'm just going to say, before we talk about before I ask you about what's going on, but it's beautifully depicted, isn't it? Those final scenes of Dream standing there with his shirt off. And then when his sister Death comes to him at the end.
I mean, we've sort of talked every now and then in the volumes where we see like a particularly good visual representation of Dream, like when he's like in his full 80s, or like there's been some really good art. I think we've pointed that out in the past, and I think this is another example of that. Just like the hair is like flowing, he's wearing jeans, and it's just like
it's raining and there's lightning in the background. Yeah, it's beautifully done. And then of course his sister Death comes to him, and they have a final conversation on this pinnacle of rock before she just says, take my hand, brother, I think.
Yeah.
Is that what she says? She does. Give me your hand.
We have a little sort of like reflection back to the sound of her wings where they're like feeding pigeons.
Yes.
And
which is nice. It's a lovely brother and sister moment in a way, isn't it?
You know, Dream is kind of, we talk about how Dream is kind of awful unless he's talking to like Death, Delirium, or like Hob.
Hob or Gadlin,
like Lucien,
yeah.
Sometimes, I guess, as well. Like, he's kind of an awful character unless he's like interacting with these much better characters. This is a nice moment. It sort of feels like it's almost anticlimactic because it's like we've been expecting this big, I don't know, battle or gory death who sort of, as the Furies have been going around, killing off Dreams, killing off even Merv Pumpkinhead.
Not Merv Pumpkinhead.
He gets it after he has his like little, like, I don't know, is that's, it feels...
His action
hero
speech.
Yeah, it feels like it's a direct reference to like Rambo or like a Vietnam film. He gets his little like action hero moment and then gets it. Yeah, so then we just have this sort of final moment of like Dream...
We don't play the Grail page game on this podcast. We have talked about that Jill Thompson double page spread from Brief Lives. But one of these pages of Dream and Death standing there in the storm, if it didn't contain quite so many spoilers, I would post that one as well, because they're quite stunning and beautiful pages by Mark Hempel and Disraeli.
They are. They're really good. And I think we see, I don't know, it's quite... I don't want to say that I'm happy that Dream dies, but it's an interesting way to sort of round up this story and not really necessarily give Dream the hero's ending, but to give him this slightly like softer resignation to his fate kind of ending, which I think I like it as a sort of like, this is how this had to end. I think these stories kind of get tied up in bows, and like that's kind of satisfying as a reader sometimes to have that. Yeah, so I like how this story resolves, and I think, you know, we always knew Death was going to be there, but it's always nice to see her.
Yes, and as ever, she does seem like this remarkable lightning of the mood when she comes in. I love the bit where she tells the kindly ones, basically, okay, you've done your bit, go away, you know.
Yeah.
And they say, I don't think they use this language, but they say, basically, we've just been following the rules, ma'am. And she says, enough, go. So the kindly ones as a volume, we know, I mean, spoilers, but anybody listening to this, I'm sure, knows this is the volume where Dream basically dies at the end and is replaced by a new Dream Lord in the form of his sort of dream son, Daniel, or the boy Daniel, yeah, who was conceived in the Dreaming. So here's the question. Neil Gaiman has famously said that the Sandman is about the Lord of Dreams learns that one must change or die, and he makes his decision. And as you know from our previous volumes, Jen, I've been talking about Dream and whether or not he was changing, and this sort of like constant idea that characters kept saying to him he's changed from his 70 years in the glass prison. Has he changed? Does he decide to change, or does he just decide to die, do you think?
I think he decides to die. I think we've talked about how, whether we believe the changes to be fundamental, shall we say, or whether they are just sort of surface level and always prompted by outsiders. Yeah, I think he decides to leave, shall we say, but not in the same way that Destruction does, because he feels he has a duty to keep the Dreaming in check. And I guess there's some truth to that, because we've seen that when he is absent, he knows what happens when he's absent from Dreaming, shall we say. Like, he knows the Corinthian will run wild and cause a wave of serial killers in the US. And so, like, there's definitely, you know, there's definitely reasons for someone to be in charge of the dreaming. Yeah, I think he decides to step aside and leave and die. I think he manages to make more mistakes on his way to that that conclusion, though. So, yeah.
I think it's interesting. I mean, we won't go into too much of the intricacies of the plot and who exactly Loki and Puck were working for. But it seems clear, particularly from what Death says to him at the end, that this is something he's been making plans for. And she says, this is what you've been planning, even without letting yourself know that's what you were doing.
Yeah.
And he's put in place various, I don't know what you would say, a scheme to make sure that there is a new Dream Lord and that the dreaming will continue and that somebody else will take over what he keeps referring to as his responsibilities. Even though perhaps his planning wasn't overt all the time, or even, you know, as Death says to him, even if that he didn't quite realise what he was doing sometimes while he was doing it. But it seems like the end of a long, complicated idea that possibly he had while he was in that glass globe for 70 years.
Yeah, and we see that, like, there's an indication, I think, when Delirium talks to Lucifer that there was other options to take. And, you know, they will keep referring to destruction. Destruction took a different way out. So, yeah, there's always... I think we've been pretty clear that, like, Dream knows this is coming from sort of brief lives. He definitely knows it's coming. And then, like, there's hints of that beforehand as well. You know, even the first time he meets Lita in the doll's house. Yeah. He marks Daniel at that point, I think, as he will be needed at some point. So yeah, I think Dream knew it was coming. And again, I can't help but feeling that the female characters become the ones who get the trouble, who have to, like, deal with it, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Thinking here, like, obviously Rose is sent on this, like, slightly wild goose chase almost. But I think Lita in particular is the character most wronged in the books, and I believe there will be a sense of stuff being tied up in the next volume, in The Wake. But at this point, I can't help pointing out that at the end of The Kindly Ones, which was the narrative and action was kicked off by Daniel being stolen and Lita going to track him down, and The Kindly Ones using Lita's need for vengeance to fuel their actions, we end up with Daniel being the new Dream and Lita waking up in, you know, a flat in LA without a baby, with knowledge of everything that's been going on. And it sort of feels cruel again to have a character who is the sort of, like, main impetus for a lot of the drama.
There's that bit, because we should say Thessaly is back in this volume, yeah, although she's now calling herself Larissa, which I guess is the name of an island or a capital in Thessaly, I think, something like that. Anyway, I think it's confirmed, you know, we learn in this volume that she was indeed the brief lover of Dream that he was sort of getting over a breakup with in brief lives. And she's done a deal with the Kindly Ones to get some more years added on, basically, more life. And what she does is she protects the sort of, what could we say, the sort of waking world version of Leta Hall,
yeah,
from Dream himself. And then at the end of the book, as you say, Leta wakes up when this is all done. Dream is dead and Daniel has gone on to be the new Dream Lord. So she wakes up battered and covered in foul-smelling sort of magical herby paints in Larissa's apartment. And Larissa says, you better start running. Lots of people are going to want to hurt you for what you've done, including me. So, you know, it's very unfortunate for Lita. And in fact, for lots of female characters throughout this.
Yeah, I always think about this. I think you've probably heard me refer to this as well. This is Amy's baby, which is
Amy Pond
it's
from
Amy
Doctor
Pond's
Who.
Amy Pond's baby from Doctor Who, because it is the point at which I got fed up with carrying on watching Doctor Who, because I could not understand why Amy did not get her baby back. Like, I didn't. Obviously, there's a narrative reason, and I won't spoil that here. I'm sure everyone listening here is at least aware of Doctor Who.
We're not the Doctor Who podcast. We're not the Doctor Who. Spoil that.
We're not the Doctor Who podcast. But yeah, I could not understand why you set up a sort of narrative drive of, like, I guess a parent, full stop, but, like, you know, like a female parent narrative drive to, like, find a child that has been taken or a child that is lost, and then not feel like you need to resolve that quest in a way, or even, like, acknowledge the failure of that quest, shall we say. Like, both Leeta and Amy Pond now have this, like, loss and this absence that is not acknowledged within the storyline. And I think, like I say, I'm pretty sure that Leeta comes back in the wake. So maybe in the next episode, you'll either hear me being like, I'm sorry, she does get her moment. She does get her brief, like, moment of grief or acknowledgement of that loss. But at this point, it's sort of like at the end of the book, it's like forgotten that she had any reason to be mad or angry at all, you know, like, and now it becomes like, oh, you fucked up and now you're in trouble. It's like, no, she was like, she has been nothing but, she's been nothing but like a pawn in other people's stories. Like, when we first meet her, she's just like tagging along to this like world in the dreaming that she's like not in control of, and then she comes out and dreams like that's baby's mine, and she's like, that's not your baby. And then he just, you know, he comes to collect, or someone collects beforehand. So yeah, she's not given a lot of agency other than this like vengeance agency in the book. She's not good writing.
Because I'm slightly further ahead in my reading than you, I can say that she does get an encounter with the Dream Lord, but I don't think she gets... I don't think we see her standing at, for instance, Carla or indeed Daniel's graveside. She doesn't get that sort of moment of what, you know, what's been referred to earlier on in the Sandman run as the like human mourning. You know, you mourn and then you carry on.
I mean, you know, there's a point in this where it's in here where she goes on a date, or and they're talking about her and Carla are talking about like, she was a superhero. She didn't know her mother. She was a superhero. She, like, disappears, or as we know, gets stuck in the dreaming with her husband who dies. And then she comes back and she's still pregnant after, like, 4 years. And then she has a baby, and then she's a single mother, and then her baby disappears, and it's like, well... And now she's, like, possibly being threatened by anyone who is upset by the fact that Dream is dead. So it's just like, cool.
So... I'm going to go back to Dream again for a moment about what was his plan. As you know, Jenny, I am approaching retirement. And when I read The Sandman this time, when I read Brief Lives and we saw Destruction basically living in a sort of, as I think I called him, a tech giants or a, you know, a tech billionaires type of retirement, Lucifer, who's just basically just decided to give it all up, hang it up, literally hang up his wings and then go and run a nightclub in LA, which is rather entertaining. Although we know from TV, from further series and television, he then goes on to solve crimes as well, doesn't he? And then the Dream, who sort of decides he's not going to retire. He's just going to die in harness, basically. He's just going to, you know, work till he drops and then he's replaced and he'll just be a memory. But I wondered, as I'm thinking about that and the various models of retirement we see in this comic, why we don't get to see any sort of female versions, you know? The women, Carla and Nada and Ruby, all get burnt horribly to death. Leeta's now stalked. Zelda and Chantel die in hospices. Maybe it's only Rose Walker who might give us a positive sort of outcome. We'll find out maybe in the next volume.
Yeah, I mean, we talked before about how the end of The Doll's House, after this like incredibly traumatic storyline, Rose is given a sort of positive ending, and she's not her depiction in this is not positive, but it is a sort of like, maybe implies that ending wasn't as like final, because it was sort of, you know, she still has a whole situation, she's still very much embroiled in this sort of like world that is beyond her control, and like, obviously, yeah, as we've literally just discovered today, maybe still, you know, involved.
Still being a pawn in Desire's game.
So there's, like, none of the female characters get out free, other than Delirium, who gets a dog.
Delirium gets the wonderful dog back. We know that Despair is the second version of Despair. But again, the first version died. She doesn't live on happily somewhere else in retirement, does she? Nope.
And we have not really talked about Nuala, the fairy, who in the course of this story is like bartered around between Dream and Titania and her brother, and reveals at a certain point that she is in love with Dream, and then becomes the sort of like, much like Leta, is almost used as a narrative pawn to like get the finale on the way, you know? She's sort of responsible for weakening Dream's defences at the end. So yeah, they don't get a good run, these characters.
And I did notice the rather sort of, I don't know if it's an authorial thing of having every woman in the book fall in love with Dream. You know, Titania's in love with him, and Nuala's in love with him. You know, all these characters who fall in love with him. And we can't really for the life of us in a way see why, because of all the faults that we've exposed while we've been talking about him.
Yeah.
But it does seem, I mean, you know, it's a bit like Ian Fleming with James Bond, that, you know, James in the books, all the women fall for James Bond. I noticed it when I read the Inspector Morse books as well. You know, they're very much, Morse is sort of like a reflection of Colin Dexter, who wrote them, and women inexplicably keep falling in love with this overweight, alcoholic, miserable detective. But anyway, yes, it's a pity we don't get a more interesting depiction of the fate of some of the women in this book. But there you go. Dream has, I guess, achieved what he wanted to. I notice you mentioned Nuala, because he does at the end, when he's talking to Death, say that, you know, oh, if Nuala hadn't called me away from the dream in at a critical moment. And fortunately, Death just says, bullshit, and you know it.
Yeah. He's always looking for someone to blame, is Death.
Yes, exactly. Do not blame this on Nuala. You knew what you were doing. Yeah. It's also that other line I think I wanted to mention earlier, where he says, I'm very tired, sister. I think he's just had enough, hasn't he?
And I mean, to be fair, just fed up. A lot of stuff has gone on. He's had a busy couple of years since he was freed from a globe, from a dome, from a glass dome.
From a snow dome.
Yeah.
a snow globe, yeah.
He's been up to a lot of stuff, but yeah, I think there's this sort of essence of Dream that he will never be like content or happy. He will always be sort of like looking for more, I guess, as a aspect of his character.
So that is Volume 9, The Kindly Ones. Culmination of whatever Dream was planning for himself over the previous 69 issues or thereabouts. Any closing thoughts about The Kindly Ones, Jen?
I enjoy The Kindly Ones. It was a bit of a slog to read it, and I wondered if it would have been different if you were reading it issue by issue, because it would have been like, oh, what happens next? I have to wait a month.
It was.
You know, so it maybe wouldn't have felt like it did for me, like they were, like he just kept leading us down like paths that we didn't need to go down, you know. He was just sort of killing time trying to get to the end. So I wondered if future advice to myself or others to read it slowly and to like let it go by issue might be the way to approach it. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
I enjoyed it. I did enjoy it. I enjoyed it more this time with some of the sort of insights and ideas that we've had from our reread. I did find that one particular moment of Carla so jarring and so distressing to come across. But apart from that, I enjoyed it. I thought the artwork was just fantastic. This might be some of my favourite artwork on The Sandman, particularly, as I say, those final scenes where he's confronting the Kindly Ones on top of whatever that stone pinnacle is. And when Death turns up and she just looks fantastic, and she is fantastic, and she is as ever. She's kind and caring and no nonsense. So yeah, I did enjoy reading it. I am looking forward to The Wake, which will be volume 10, hopefully next week or the week after this podcast comes out, when we will wrap up the run of The Sandman. We'll talk about the last trade. We'll probably also have time, hopefully, for some reflections, some fables and reflections of our own on the entire run and what we've learned from this reread process. Do you remember much about The Wake?
Nope. I remember, I think I remember the scene with Lita and Daniel, but I think that is all I can really remember. So I'm looking forward to reading it again. I just had a thought, there was something I was going to make a note to say out loud, because earlier when we spoke about the Midsummer Night's Dream issue, way back when...
Dream Country, in episode 3.
I mentioned Hope Mearley's, I'm not sure how to pronounce the author whose book I was reading at the time, which was about fairy, and I mentioned that the world seemed very similar, and then Neil Gaiman has a quote on the front of the paperback I was reading, so I was like, he must have known about her. And then in The Kindly Ones, at the end, Lucien gives Death a book and says it's one of Miss Mearley's best. She often thought it was like one of her dream books, and I thought, he did know her at this point. He had read her. She clearly was a reference.
I hadn't made the connection, but that's a good call. Yes, indeed. Lucien, again, lending books to Death.
Yeah.
Ah, right.
I thought it's the first time there has been a reference in this that I have gotten. that is not a DC hero or like.
I get most of the DC callbacks, but you can get the real world books.
I'll get this one real world book and the time when in Brief Lives Delirium blows bubbles and she blows Totoro from My Neighbor Totoro. Those are the two.
Fantastic. Well, thank you everybody for listening to episode 9 of A Handful of Dust. We hope you're enjoying the trip with us. Next time we'll be on to the final volume 10, The Wake. We'll also maybe talk a little bit about what our plans are for some spin-offs that we're going to cover. Until then, I'm Eamon.
And I'm Jenny.
And thank you for listening.
Bye.